What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "My story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right: How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair.
Welcome, everyone, to another Shooting the Shit. I am Cece. I am here with Carly, of course, but if you're watching us on YouTube, you already know we have a very special guest. Maybe you know her as a journalist. Maybe you know her as a New York Times bestselling author. Maybe you know her as Reese's Book Club pick. Maybe you know her from one of the many, many pieces that she has published in fabulous mediums such as the New York Times, Vogue, Psychology Today. Possibly you know her because I talk about her books all the time because I'm obsessed with her writing. And once upon a time, I was so curious about an ending to a specific novel of hers that I threatened to be in an elevator with her, find a way to stop the elevator just so I could ask a question. Now I have her here on our show. So I didn't have to do that, and that was good. But most recently, she is most famous for being the lead plaintiff in the landmark class action lawsuit, BART versus Anthropic, which was, of course, the first major win for creatives against an AI company, as well as the largest copyright recovery in history. Welcome, Andrea Bartz.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think this is way more fun than being trapped in an elevator together. So thanks for not doing that. I know. I believed you.
I was going to do it. And then I didn't have to because you agreed to come on and talk to me. So I was like, yay.
You don't make empty threats. I knew that.
Well, we're so glad you're our inaugural guest on our Monday show. You know, we've kind of teased over, we've been doing this almost a year where it's more off the cuff and kind of publishing conversation. And we've been teasing, like, you know, we'll have a guest at some point. Who will be our perfect first guest? And starting in you know, January, there hasn't a week gone by that we haven't talked about AI or, you know, obviously the case. And there's so much to talk about. And we're so glad that you're here. So because this is our more casual kind of Monday show, and, you know, we're not grilling you necessarily about, you know, your books in particular, but obviously we're thrilled that you're here as such an accomplished author. I wanted to pick your brain just about like the cultural moment side of things and like what's going on in your head. How does your career feel? How are just like the author group chats going? What are the vibes like? I just want a vibe check from a best-selling author.
The vibes are chaotic. The vibes are all over the place, which I imagine is the case for the group chats of everyone in publishing right now. It feels like, other than yesteryear, nobody really understands like what's working and why. And books that are getting a big amount of excitement before publication, then the sales aren't matching. Stuff that, you know, doesn't seem like it's getting a lot of attention beforehand suddenly like are taking off, and everyone just feels like everything is kind of out of our hands, which is really scary in some way, but also, I don't know, kind of liberating in others. Maybe it's because I have like 5 books out, but by now I'm kind of like, there's not that much you can do anyway. So just write the book you want to write. But I think, yeah, there's a lot of fear around AI, a lot of discussion and concern. Maybe concern's a better word than fear, although I'm fearful. And just a lot of like throwing our hands up and being like, what on earth is going on? What, mm-hmm. what is working? What is moving the needle? And what are we supposed to be doing? And what's actually, you know, what efforts are in vain and what efforts are actually working? And it just seems like there's no clear patterns. And that's maybe been true for a while, but it feels especially true right now when like the news cycle is so bananas and AI is shaking everything up and the publishing industry hasn't, at least to us, sort of told us how it's going to deal with it. Just a lot of feeling like we're in the middle of a tornado.
So yeah. No big deal. It's like, you know, the group chats are fine. And
it's a regular Monday.
I know. Like, I'm trying to get, I guess the heart of the question is kind of like, you've been in the business a while. We've been in the business a while. Why does now feel like the moment that feels so uncertain? Is it really just AI, or is it the confluence of all of these things from the tech side of things? Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, do you think it's now? It's singular?
I think it does feel worse. I mean, like, you know, we all have the generational narcissism of thinking we're living in the climax of history. And I guess every generation has felt like that. But I really feel like things right now are worse than they have been at other points, certainly in my life and like things that other generations were dealing with. It feels like the wheels are coming off the buses on all levels. And I think AI is exacerbating that. I think it's speeding it up. I think it's, you know, creating uncertainty on every level in the economy, in every field, in every sector. But it just feels like the wheels are falling off the bus. I mean, when you look at what's happening politically in the US, it's like, what are we doing? Everything feels like no one's in charge and everything, all of our systems are crumbling. And, you know, the optimists among us might say, well, that's great because then we get to build something new. But right now it feels like we are... Again, I keep saying tornado. It feels like we are in just a tornado, and like we are clinging to little Toto for dear life and hoping that we land on 2 feet. But I think that's definitely being felt in publishing too. And when there's so much going on that's, you know, drawing all of our attention, it's especially hard to like put a book out and be like, hey, everybody pay attention to this. One of like 4 million books that came out this year that I worked on that was the most important thing to me, but that is just one little thing flying past you on the jetsam today. So I think it's everything and not just AI, but certainly AI is exacerbating it and kind of intensifying it.
I mean, first we have to save Toto. I feel like that's something we can all agree on. We absolutely just must as
cling
animal
to your
lovers.
Fur babies.
Cling to your fur babies. And you know, I understand what you're saying about how it does feel weird to promote a book. I've heard this from so many authors at the same time. And I have no right to ask anyone to do this, but I'm going to anyway. Now is when we need you guys more than ever to do this, right? Like, thank God for storytellers, because we need books more than ever because of how hard things are. So it's this actually very interesting paradox that I think about a lot, which just makes the tornado metaphor even more perfect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's swirling. It's a vortex, but I totally agree. It's like people, we need more readers. More than ever, we need people experiencing that empathy, that compassion, experiencing a one-way medium of having to sit with conflict and uncomfortable ideas instead of just, you know, interacting with a chatbot that's sycophantic and will agree with them anyway. The books that we write, these themes we're trying to express, the way that we're trying to help people literally imagine a different world and the way things could be as authors, these are so important. And so when you're promoting your book, you're not just shilling, you're not just asking someone to buy something, though of course there is that too. You're also giving this gift and trying to get out this thing that's really going to help that reader and help people. And I try to remind myself of that because it does feel weird and hard to be like, buy my book.
I like that.
Yeah. I just want to shake everybody and be like, put your phones down, pick up a book. Like, phone down, book up. Like, that's all we're asking. Just step away from the technology. I want to come back to something you said about, like, nobody knows how to promote anything maybe other than yesteryear, or like, maybe that's one of the only thing that's working. You know, there was an article that came out, I think it was on Monday, it's Thursday when we're recording, calling some big books of the spring like rage bait, you know, yesteryear, fame sick, strangers, you know, as like some of the, you know, larger books of the first half of the year. Have you read these books? Do you have thoughts about them? Do you have any thoughts about like why they're working or not, you know, like why they're resonating with people? Because people keep kind of coming back to those three.
I think, the discourse around them has been absolutely fascinating, but I can't help but also put adult braces into that category. And yet that one didn't sell that well, surprisingly. There was so much conversation around it, but it felt like it didn't get reflected in book sales in the same way. But I think people want distraction more than ever. And people want to finish a book and feel like they need everyone else to read, even if they hated it, they need everyone else to read it so that they can discuss it with them. And I think right now is a really tough time to be writing like quiet books. And the conversation has gotten so loud and so sort of manic that the books that are breaking out are also going to be loud and going to be stuff people want to discuss and that make them feel big things so that you want to rush to your friends and say, oh my God, we need to discuss. And I mean, love it or hate it, I don't feel like I should weigh in on whether I liked or disliked these books or thought they were good or bad, but there's a lot to discuss. And what's interesting is there's a lot to discuss even if you didn't read the books, right? Mm-hmm. You can still sort of read the conversation. I'm that way with Adult Braces, I will confess. I haven't read, but I was obsessed with the discourse. And those are the kind of books that just keep this sort of self-fulfilling cycle going of everyone wants to talk about it. And then when you're at a bookstore, you're like, wait, that I know I've heard about. Now I want to be a part of the conversation too. And that's resulting in book sales.
So what was the last book that you read that you were like, I need everyone in my life to read this and I'm going to talk about it? Like, just for fun.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me think. Well, I read it a while ago because it's a book by a friend of mine, but very recently the book Marion came out, which is a reimagining of Psycho, this ragey, good
it's
for
a great
her.
Great cover, yellow
feminist,
with a knife.
Yes, yellow and pink. And it's this reimagining of Psycho where Marion like knees Norman in the balls and grabs a knife and stabs him, and it sets her off on a sort of killing spree of the men who've wronged her. And it is incredibly satisfying. And it's just what I love about it is that it's such a immediate hook, and you can immediately imagine, even if you haven't watched Psycho, you can imagine where we're going. And so that's one that I just keep shoving into people's hands to be like, read it and let's talk about it. Read it and let's talk about the surprises and the twists and where we thought it was going and where it actually went and what this is saying in a subtle way about, you know, final girls and horror books and feminist literature and where the whole field has gone since the days of Psycho. So that's one that's just really discussable that I keep shoving into people's hands.
It's interesting because I actually almost like it more when I'm talking about a book with a friend or a colleague and we have different opinions on the book. Like, I have been chatting with editors, just, you know, my usual job. And then we always talk about like books we loved just as readers because we're readers first. And sometimes we'll disagree on a really big book. And I actually find that more interesting because I'm like, wait, explain to me. Like, why did you love that ending when I really didn't like that ending or vice versa? And it's also really interesting to know people's reading habits. So I love reading in all formats, but I'm mostly an ebook reader because I read at night and I like to highlight a lot. And I've moved so many times in my life that it's just more practical. Like, I have a ton of print books around me, but I have even more. I actually have over 800 books, ebooks that I bought in my library. Wow. I've been doing this for many years. I've been reading for many years in the ebooks. What kind of format do you love most to read in?
So I am also an ebook reader for similar reasons. I've lived in various small New York City apartments. I have done a lot of traveling. I worked as a travel writer for years. And the idea of packing like 5 hardcovers or even 5 paperbacks into a suitcase was not practical. So, and I also read at night, and just being able to, you know, turn on the little subtle orangey glow is really helpful for me. So that's my go-to. I love a physical book. I love the act of like having it around, and I dabble in audiobooks, but I don't listen. I enjoy them, but I don't actually listen to them that often, because if I'm doing a task that a lot of people would add an audiobook to, like going for a walk or doing the dishes or cleaning, I really prioritize silence. I really prioritize like having time to let my mind wander and to hear my own thoughts, because I feel like that's crucial for my writing. So I mostly am an ebook reader. That's how I can really plow through a lot of books.
Carly, what about you?
Oh, format. I mean, gosh, I really try to be format agnostic. And a lot of it is just reality of my life. Like with traveling, I'm like, I love the idea of having a physical book on the beach somewhere. But then it's like, you know, what, how much am I actually going to carry in my suitcase? So that's a great question. I don't have like a rhyme or a reason. I do like to listen to audio if it is the author reading it, especially I listen to a lot of, read a lot of nonfiction. So if it's like a celebrity memoir, or the author reading their nonfiction, I think that kind of brings it to life. But yeah, I'm quite agnostic. I don't know. I don't really have a set way of doing
things.
It's great. Yeah.
You don't discriminate.
Cece, how about you?
Ebook, first and foremost, because of the volume issue I mentioned. And also because I'm reading at night and, you know, my partner's beside me and it's like, we need a nightlight. But I have a lot of print books. Sometimes I will buy a print book after buying an ebook if I really loved it. Like Lady Tremaine. I bought the print version because I'm like, I want to have it on my bookshelf. I'm not going to read it again. It doesn't matter. I just don't want to have it. I do audio, but way less than like, so it's ebook first, then print, then audio book. That actually has changed with Spotify, because Spotify now gives you, is it 15 hours a month? So because of that, I get to start to listen to a few audiobooks and see if I actually like them or not before I commit. And then I can just get my Libro FM. I can use my Libro FM credit to like buy the full book if I want to. And it doesn't feel like I'm doing anything wrong, because like I actually have those hours. It doesn't feel like I'm like, you know, listening to a sample that's unauthorized or whatever. So that's changed my audiobook habits. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I really want to get to Andy's thoughts about AI. And we're going to do that right after a word from our sponsors. As a literary agent, you know there's only one thing I like talking about more than books, and that's money. More importantly, cash that stays in your pocket. I'm on the lookout for our listeners at all times. I'm combing deal memos and book publishing contracts for hidden ways that writers are on the hook, and that's why we are thrilled to partner with Chime, who's changing the way people bank. They offer the most rewarding fee-free banking built just for you. That's right, built for you, not the 1%. Chime members can benefit from up to $1,150 in annual rewards, fee-free. Direct deposit unlocks the most rewarding way to bank at Chime. Chime is rated 5 stars by USA Today for customer service. That's real humans 24/7. You're not just switching banks, you're upgrading to America's number one choice for banking with a Chime checking account. They're not like traditional old banks that charge you overdraft and monthly fees. And if you're like me and travel a bunch and love premium travel perks like airport lounge access, you've got it. And the 24/7 travel concierge included with your Chime card. My younger self would have loved a fast-tracked airport lounge access. You get 5% cash back on Chime card in a category of your choice, like gas or groceries for your next writer's retreat. You get savings that grow faster with 3.75 APY. That's 9 times higher than the national average. You can even get up to $500 of your pay when you say, with my pay. They also have SpotMe, which lets you overdraft up to $200 fee-free. Chime is not just smarter banking. It's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. Head to chime.com/dsnotya. That's chime.com/dsnotya. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime Card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
I am currently packing right now for the Alps. And if you're like me and have travel coming up, whether it's summer vacations, an international work trip, weddings that require a flight to get to, imagine arriving actually understanding the language, ordering confidently at restaurants, connecting with locals at museums, feeling immersed instead of just visiting. I'm off to Germany and Austria right now, and I am so glad that Rosetta Stone is here to lend a hand. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language. No memorizing random vocabulary lists and no relying on translations. Instead, you learned by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context. The way language is meant to be learned. My German will get better soon because of the top-rated True Accent feature, which is designed to give real-time feedback on pronunciation via native speakers. The new chat missions feature will let you put your new language skills to test in immersive and practical scenarios related to work, travel, and more. Speak like a local. The lessons are simple to add to the regular schedule of your day with the app or desktop. Fit it in whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. The app now has learning games where you can get writing tips and more. Learn faster and retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. Ready to start learning a new language this summer? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey today. All right, welcome back, everybody. So there was the U.S. Book Show event in early June, and there was a really great panel with publishers talking about AI, and just the kind of current state of the situation. And so I grabbed some quotes from Publishers Lunch who reported on it and just kind of wanted to run through some of those quotes and obviously chat with Andy about this. And, you know, because I know this panel has the Hachette CEO, the Sourcebook CEO, the Authors Equity CEO, and so I'm sure Andy knows many authors who, you know, are authors under all of these imprints as well. And everybody has lots of opinions depending on the publisher they're at and their own feelings and you yourself. So bring your expertise to the conversation. But the first quote is from the Hachette CEO, David Shelley. So he didn't reference the canceled Shy Girl book or have a specific answer, but he said that the company doesn't have a systemic way of checking for AI authorship. He said that AI detection programs are largely imperfect and that authors have concerns about their work being fed into such a tool. He also doesn't want to encourage a culture of suspicion or disbelief of authors, but said that the company has a contractual policy that authors must disclose their use of AI. And I think this kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, Andy, about like there are these policies, but like, are they policies and are publishers actually like putting their foot down about things? It all just sounds lovely, but like also we're not really putting a stake in the ground on this. Like if you don't have a systemic way of checking for AI authorship, then we're all just going on faith. We know that the tools are imperfect and authors don't want their, you know, words put into it anyway. So I just thought that was like, he's saying all the right things. And yet, why don't we actually feel like satisfied by what he's saying? I don't know if that resonated with you guys at all.
Yeah. It feels like such a nothing burger. I mean, I actually was just talking to my editor about, and I said, you know, all the publishers really need to get out there and be loud and clear about mm-hmm. where the line in the sand is on AI. And she kind of said, we're working on it. We're talking about it internally. You know, things move. This is my opinion, not her, but like things move so slowly in publishing. It's not like they're going to, you know, pivot and have some big thing to say after a week. But she also mentioned, and this is not surprising at all, but publishing, like every company, is kind of encouraging its employees, and in some cases really pushing its employees, to be using AI for, you know, productivity improvements, right? For mm-hmm. not the creative stuff, but using it in other ways. And to me, this is just all, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh yeah, this product that's, you know, built off of, you know, the stolen ebooks of copyrighted materials without consent or compensation. We want you to use it. We want you to get really comfortable with it. But then also there's some invisible line that authors should just inherently understand about how they're allowed to use it. It's a mess. And, you know, he's not, the CEO is not wrong. The AI checkers are imperfect. I briefly thought that a few were really good. And then I was proven wrong by other people saying, well, look what happened when I fed this AI written thing into it. And it came back as 100% human made, or, you know, human written. Some of them do take the input and feed it back into sort of as training materials. So there is that issue of, you know, my work being used to train an AI algorithm without my consent. Other ones, some of the detectors very purposely use systems that delete the work after, that don't feed it back in. But either way, they're really, really imperfect. We're in a weird spot where readers are making it clear, especially with things like the Shy Girl scandal, that they don't want books that are written by AI, which is good. We should be telling our publishers that. But my fear is that what that encourages is for authors to conceal their own AI use if they are using it. I just think we need really clear lines in the sand. And I personally think that the line should be, you are not using it in any way. And that includes research, and that includes copy editing, and that includes you know, grammar checks and your own sort of word processing. It's really frightening to me how many authors I respect who say, oh, I don't use it for writing, but I use it for research. And I say, well, do you know that about a quarter of the time it's wrong and you shouldn't do that? Mm-hmm. And it's sucking up, you know, our fresh water, and it's built on and enriching some of the most sociopathic CEOs on the planet, et cetera, et cetera. So I can really rant and I will stop there, but I don't think authors should be using it in any aspect of their professional life personally.
I just play devil's advocate. So say I was an author, friend, colleague of yours, and I said, but Andy, every platform I go to, whether it's Google or this or that, the other has AI in it. So how would one do research in 2026 without AI touching it in some capacity? And what would you say to that person?
So that's what I was going to ask. And I'll just add to that. Because again, like in terms of morals, so aligned. In terms of how do I practically do that when, like you mentioned copy editing, or like, I'm pretty sure that the word spell check is powered by AI at this point. I actually don't know that for sure, but I think so. And like, I write on Word. I'm talking about writing emails. I'm not talking about writing books. I don't write books. But how does an author navigate that? You know, like we need Word, Microsoft Word. I'm sorry, but we need it.
We do need Word. I agree. It is completely infuriating how everything that we already use is having AI, you know, sprinkled all over it. And in the year of our Lord 2026, it's not possible to entirely avoid it. And then that's to say nothing too of, this isn't generative AI, but the algorithmic AI of being on Meta, of having an Instagram account, of being on Substack, any of those. So my position is, in every way that I can avoid it, which right now means going a little bit beyond and having to do a little bit of work, every way that I can avoid it, I do. So a really easy example is that I still use Chrome. I probably should eventually switch to Firefox or something else. But in my Chrome, I've set DuckDuckGo as the default browser. So now when I open up a tab and I type my question into the, you know, browser bar at the top, instead of getting AI results from Google, I get something that looks more like Google pre-AI. I still get a summary of information at the top, and it cites the source, but it's not AI written, and it's private. And then I actually have to sift through the results, which are ranked in a more traditional, you know, SEO way, and to look into anything, fact check things myself, verify. So that's just an easy example of like, yeah, you might have to change your behavior a tiny bit in order to do research without AI. But in all of the ways that one can opt out, I think one should opt out. I think it was actually incredible. Once I downloaded DuckDuckGo, I like remembered the muscles that came with getting search results and looking through them. And it was really satisfying. It was like, I felt like, you know, a pioneer woman reading through a whole page of results. Imagine that. And it made my brain happier. And I felt so much more satisfied from getting these answers and figuring this out. I think black and white thinking is dangerous in any capacity, right? And so to say, oh, well, I have to use it for work, so I might as well use AI and everything else in my life, or it's so incredibly crucial for me in this one aspect of, you know, doing data analytics on your own projects or you know, preparing a certain kind of report for somebody for work. It's so crucial for that I might as well throw out my hands and use it every way. I think I'm very much in the like vegan but cheese mentality. People say, oh, I would totally be vegan except cheese. And it's like, well, then be vegan with cheese. You can still do that. It does not have to be all or nothing. It does not have to be black or white. And my feeling is if there are certain use cases you absolutely have decided are worth it for you and you can't get rid of them, fine. But in every other way, like figure out it's doable to figure out how to do research for your books without using AI. It's, you know, maybe Word is still doing its spell checker. I'm actually not sure, but it probably is AI assisted in some way. So maybe you're still using the built-in AI checker, but you're not using Grammarly, which Grammarly is much more heavily AI intensive. Where can you make choices that bring you as close to fully living your values about AI everywhere in your professional life?
I love it. Okay, so the next quote from the event was the Sourcebook CEO, Dominique Racca, said that they are consistently testing AI detection programs, but they're mostly bad. More importantly, she said, it is the connection between the editor and author. And I think, like, to me, that's just the heart of the trust of it all between all of us. You know, like, this industry runs so much on people and the interactions that we have with each other. And I think where I really struggle with this, like, existential question of it all is like, if the breakdown, if we continue to break down that trust and erode the trust between publisher and agent, publisher and author, author and agent, agent and publisher. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, once that starts to break down, that's the part that actually worries me the most. It's the erosion of trust. And that's the thing that keeps me up at night.
Yeah. Well, and not to mention reader and publishing in general. Yeah. I mean, I've seen people comment on social media and on even my New York Times articles, you know, I've decided I'm not going to buy any books that were published after 2023, because then I know that AI wasn't used for them. And I'm like, well, that's a really quick way to tank an entire industry, to just declare wholesale that you're not going to buy new books. And that's sort of what we're risking by not taking, in my opinion, strong stands and not coming out, for example, as a publisher and saying, we will not tolerate AI, you know, chatbot use in our books. We won't publish anything that AI has touched. That is going to hopefully give a reader some confidence that they can, you know, pick it up and feel less nervous about it. Likewise, I think I'm always encouraging authors, make your stance public, be loud about the fact that you are choosing not to use it, so that, yeah, it's still a trust thing. It's still a, you know, taking your word kind of thing, but readers can know, here's an author who has loudly stated that they will not use AI in their books. And so when I read them, I can believe them. Because if that erosion between the reader and the publishing industry, the books they put out, is eroded, you know, we've lost our ability to sell books. We've lost our market. And that's really frightening. But I think too, actually, this is an interesting point about the editor and author relationship, and I would say also the agent author relationship, is this is conversations authors should be having with their publishing team. And, you know, if you're in a point where you're deciding between agents to query with, or you're on submission, or going to auction and talking to different publishing houses, I think it's worth asking, what's your position on AI, you know, how authors' use of AI, how you guys are going to use it in-house, and just being loud about it, because the industry needs to hear that authors care. We're the ones creating the product, that agents care. Agents are the ones like bringing them the projects that make them money, right? And that readers care in order for them to have a backbone.
And I would love to see this become a more common conversation, like you said, when authors are choosing their home. So one of the most interesting things about our job, one of the most fun things about our job, is whenever we're in an auction situation and we're meeting with multiple editors, usually via Zoom, and their teams are there often. And then, you know, as an agent and as my client's advocate, I have to tell them, like, you get to ask questions. You know, this is when they're going to ask questions of you, but you are also asking questions of them. We're really vetting for fit, you know, like it's not just you trying to impress them. It works both ways. And one of the really pressing questions, to your point, Andy, really is like, what is your company's policy on AI? Because if a publisher comes out and they have a really strong pro-creative, pro-human creativity stance, they are going to stand out in the best way possible. Now, that's going to count in the same way that more money counts, you know, because there's real value in that.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the next quote that stood out to me was from Authors Equity CEO Madeline McIntosh. It did not plan for vetting books, and said the problem with AI was theft and mediocrity. That's what Cece and I always harp on. I mean, both of these things,
Thank
but
you,
the
Madeline.
Mediocrity piece. I'm like, why would you want to just be average? Like, that's the piece that just blows my mind. And
sounds
like
boring.
Andy, that must like just rattle your author brain, where you're like, the goal when we create books and, you know, creatively write isn't mediocrity. That's not the goal.
Yeah. It's wild what some people think is like the role of being an author. I did an interview. I did a radio interview on live radio interview where they interplayed an earlier conversation that the host had had with that author who writes 200 plus books a year, the romance author who had been profiled in the Times. And she was saying just completely bananas to me, like, you know, somewhere along the road decided that being an author needs to be hard. And I just decided to not, why should I spend all this time on the parts that I don't like when I can focus on the fun parts that I do enjoy? And it's like, well, then you shouldn't be an author. That's fine. But then maybe your role is not to call yourself an author and put your name on the front of these books as if you wrote them when you didn't. A chatbot generated them. It's really I don't know. I've also heard from authors saying things like, oh, I started catching myself when I use an M dash and trying to use something else instead. Oh, no. And I'm trying to watch for my lists of three. Do you do that? And I never do that. I write in many ways in those patterns that AI copies from us. And right. It's like, I just focus on having my writing be good. Yes. And then I can look people in the eye and say, of course, AI did not help me write this. And if you want to accuse it of that, because there's a list of three, you're wrong. And I can say that without blinking an eye. And that is how I, beat back against accusations of AI. But it is true, the mediocrity issue.
Well, thank you for not stopping that. Because M dashes, lists of threes, that's all part of good writing. I just refuse to listen to that discourse. It's just so horrible.
We were, one of those things that you just said, we were talking about on the show maybe a month or so ago, is this concept of how are authors going to surveil their own work if they have to prove that it's theirs? Have you thought about that? Or do you talk with your author group about what happens, if the pitchforks come for me?
It's really scary. I think about it. I don't have an answer. I don't think other people have an answer. It does alarm me that especially people who are writing about controversial topics, people from, marginalized communities, it could become sort of a witch hunt situation where if somebody doesn't like you for whatever reason, instead of trying to destroy you some other way, they can try to get you canceled by just claiming your work is AI written. And how can you genuinely prove it? I mean,
how do you prove a negative process?
Right, exactly. There's apparently now AI in this arms race that can make it look like somebody is writing. So instead of just shooting out text the way that a ChatGPT would, it does it to emulate human writing, and it does backspace and it introduces errors and it moves things around. So even a sort of tracker won't necessarily be able to catch the way that ChatGPT would generate text versus the way that a human would generate text. It's terrifying that this is what we're giving up our fresh water for. This incredibly stupid arms race, but I don't think there is a clear way to prove it unless you're writing everything by hand. You can certainly prove a positive if somebody has said they use AI or if somebody has, for example, left AI prompts in there, but otherwise it's so much of it is going to come down to trust. And I think a lot of that, and you guys are great about talking about this, a lot of that comes down to having an author brand and being a person who shows your face to your readers and lets them know who you are and what you stand for, and sort of creates a connection with readers that goes beyond just the product, just the book. And that's a thing that will help, but all of this is still squishy and imperfect, and it's really scary.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the perfect time for us to turn it over to you for your rant. So as the listeners have known, and as Andy knows, I'm a huge fan of the Los Culturistas podcast, and they do this Honey, I Don't Think So rant where the guests get to rant. And I always thought our, shooting the shit, Cece and I are always ranting about something. And so if we were to have a guest on, that they would have to decide what their rant was going to be. And so I'm really thrilled. Andy took it very seriously, thought about a couple of topics that might be right for a rant. So yeah, I'm gonna turn the floor over to you, and it is the inaugural Shooting the Shit rant. And Andy Martz, what is your rant?
I'm gonna be ranting about how people need to stop saying that their publishing team, quote, doesn't do anything. I hear this a lot. I feel like it's become more rampant in recent years. And I understand the sentiment, and I probably have been guilty within my group chats of saying it too. And, why don't they want to sell books, and why aren't they doing anything? But I think it doesn't help us to have this antagonistic view of the people who put our books out into the world, if we are indeed, traditionally published authors. And it's actually not true. These people do a lot of things behind the scenes that we don't really recognize and appreciate. They get our book on NetGalley. They are the only ones capable of getting, Amazon on our Amazon listing, having the additional visuals and sort of reaching other people via online marketing. They are physically printing the book. They are having it laid out. They are, paying for content for the cover and having a designer do it. There's a lot that they do that we don't give them credit for. And I think it's really pessimistic and demoralizing to always have this attitude of what are they even doing all day? Why aren't they helping me more? They're also spread thinner than ever, especially like publicity and marketing teams have more projects than ever that they're trying to get out into the world. And I think it is important to recognize what are things that I as an author can do to make this process easy, to reach new readers, to get the book out in the world, and like what's my purview and what's their purview. These are really important questions. But I would love a moratorium on just saying blanket, my publisher doesn't do anything. They didn't do anything for this book. I don't think it's true. And it's a little dismissive.
I like that rant.
Good job. Good job. We're all working hard behind the scenes.
Yes.
And if we feel like there's, sometimes I find it's just a gap in communication, like you said, right? It's like maybe that you don't know what people are doing all day, but they actually are doing a lot. And, you know, amongst many, many projects. And so the agent's job is sometimes to just call. Like I did that this week, you know, I just hadn't heard from an editor. And I was like, I know there's stuff going on behind the scenes and I know you're doing whatever, but let's just like have a quick call just to confirm so that I know, so that you know that I know, you know, just it's really, a lot of the times it's just communication.
Yes. Communication is so important. If you need more information, ask. If you're suspicious of something on your publishing team, go talk to your agent. Let them be sort of the go-between if you don't want to sound accusatory. But it's gotten out of control. I heard an author sort of ranting, well, I don't know what's going on, but my editor only reads my stuff on like nights and weekends or like while they're on vacation. And it's like, what are they doing all day? Are they like going out to lunches? And I was like, they're in meetings all day. And that's why they are even spending their nights, weekends, and vacations also doing their job by reading your stuff. I think this whole like us versus them, they don't really care about my book mentality is
editors
incorrect.
For sure care. For sure
They care so much more.
They care so much more than they can even say they do, because often they're beholden to the people who really sign the checks, like the people who own the big, big, big corporations. And sometimes there are things they have to navigate, like really tricky internal politics. But I've had so many editors tell me small things like, CC, thank you for sending that email pushing on that issue, because of your email, I got to go and advocate. And she wanted to, like she wanted to get the very best for their authors. No one does this because of any other reason other than they love stories and they love storytellers. So editors for sure care, editors, publicists, like the people in the day to day, their hearts are filled with love for books.
Yes, absolutely.
And I also feel like there's sometimes a lot of guilt associated with the things too, because if we're on Zooms all day or on calls all day, then, you know, we're feeling the guilt. It's like, oh, we're not getting to the manuscripts. And then we're reading the manuscripts at night. And then it's like, well, it's guilty. I feel guilty that I'm not fitting this into my day, or that like there isn't an opportunity for me to fit this in. And there's just a lot of pressure on all publishing people to be all things all the time. Because I think also, objectively, people think maybe like reading is fun, and we'd read for fun even if we didn't work in the business. So my evening reading, even though it's work reading, must also be fun reading. And sometimes it is, but I don't know. Does that make any sense? I feel this like guilt and I don't know, this like pressure to, I don't know. Maybe I need to talk to my therapist about this one.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense for everything that, I mean, you guys have to read an incredible amount because you're reading, right, stuff from your clients, stuff from prospective clients. You're reading to stay up to date with like what's going on in the industry and what books are breaking out. And of course you all love reading, but that doesn't mean, you know, the fact that your editor or agent has other things they need to do and read too, does not mean nobody cares about your book. And we need to all just banish that mentality. It's not helpful.
I like what you said. Like, we can't go into these relationships having that negativity. It doesn't help at all.
Exactly.
Okay, I had one last quote that I wanted to mention was, you know, often a lot of times right before we record, there's something interesting that comes across my desk. There was an interesting Authors Guild survey, and apparently it went out last week, but I didn't see it last week. I just saw Publishers Lunch did a little summary today, and I pulled this quote that I thought was interesting. It said, the study indicates yet another likely cause that surprised us. Not as many active readers actually buy the books they read today. Instead, almost 2/3 of readers obtain books for free, whether from friends, personal collections, libraries, pirated sites, or other free sources. At the same time, the study itself said that the biggest, richest authors are actually the ones who get borrowed the most, which weakens the argument that this is an anti-library positioning is needed to defend the earnings of low-paid authors. The authors with the highest name recognition and whose books libraries stock most aggressively see the greatest substitution of borrowing for buying. Anyway, I thought this was a really interesting quote about like books for free and how many people actually like aren't physically buying the books. And I think it, to me, it was speaking a lot to this concept of like how top heavy our business is. Mm. And we do know that, you know, I think what you were talking about earlier with the author brands is really important, right? Because a lot of times it's the biggest authors' brands who also carry people to buy, get them from the library instead of buy them every year. So I don't know if anything stood out to you guys from that Authors Guild survey, but I thought that was really interesting. Two-thirds of
what
readers
stands
obtain
out
books
to
for
me
free.
Is that I am super possessive. I would never let anyone borrow my books. Actually, I just don't. They are my love. I like even like I have Andy's Ark, for example, for The Last Fairy Out. Like this thing is annotated. Like my thoughts are here. I have little like vulnerable thoughts that I wrote. There's one here that says, "I feel brave. This is scary." Like this is not. These are not deep thoughts. But I'm not gonna lend this to anybody. It's mine. What are you people doing? Lending books? No, it's yours. Yeah.
Whenever I have book club at my house, I send everybody home with books because as you anybody watching on YouTube sees, like, I mean,
what are
I've
these
offer
books
copies,
you have
I have
read?
Everything.
Because I give copies of books I get that I'm not going to read. But like the books I've read and annotated, I'm not giving those.
Not
do you
that
give
I
those?
Annotate. No, I don't annotate a lot. Yeah. I guess nonfiction I do. Yeah, I guess I wouldn't give somebody an annotated book of mine. Yeah.
Annotate
yeah,
books,
that would
it helps
different.
Sales.
It's also making me think about how I am regularly putting books away in Little Free Libraries. And I feel like more people have let me know they found mm-hmm. one of my books in a Little Free Library. I think, I mean, as long as you're not using pirated sites.
Sorry, I love that immediately you think of author branding. You're like, how can I circumnavigate this?
This is my job. I'm doing this, yeah, doing this for a living. I think it's great people are using libraries, great people are passing stuff along. I really wish we had that British model where like they count up how many times your book was taken out of a library and you get money for it. I wish. Do they have that
we
in
have
Canada?
That in Canada.
They do. Yeah. Yeah.
Makes me so envious because it makes a lot of sense. I mean,
yeah.
Theoretically, a bookstore is going to order, or not a bookstore, a library is going to order more copies if it has a huge, you know, holds list, but even so, they're not even paying, you know, they're not paying the $30 out of pocket. They're getting deals for physical copies mm-hmm. from publishers. So it's not like it's mm-hmm. dramatically inflating your sales in any way.
Well, same with audio and an ebook, right? Because you can also check out like audio and stuff from, I mean, mm-hmm. I do like love libraries, please, everyone. I do not want anyone to think the opposite. But like at the same time, it does not count towards your track record. So yeah. I, with my friends, this is what I say to my friends. Like I would never say this to the larger public. So this is not a message to the larger public. If you are of a certain financial, like if you have a certain amount of money, I'm expecting you to buy those books. Like I have a friend, Jen, it's you. I'm talking about you. You listen to this podcast. She uses La Mer on her face, okay? The other day she was like, oh, can I borrow your copy of, no, go buy the book. Go buy the book. You have the $30. Like, I don't want to hear it. Yes, the author still makes money if you get it from the library. She lives in Toronto, Jen. But I want you to also buy the book. Okay. And then she promised me that if mm-hmm. she reads a book and loves it, she will buy it. So that's the compromise we found.
I think it's also like the value of entertainment. And I can't remember, Andy, for some reason, I think you've said this something about this before, or maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but the idea of like, when we get so much content and entertainment for free these days, that when we think about books, we don't always associate a price with them. And then when we see the price of a book, people are like, whoa, I mean, I'm not like that. But you know what I mean? Like, I think we have to like rebrand. We have to rebrand, you know, books as something worth paying for, you know?
This is 8 hours of entertainment, you know, that an author put years of their life into for $30. Like, that's less than we're all spending that on like two, you know, streaming subscriptions that we forgot we had, like Stars and something else. Yeah. Like, just one book is going to be a really great experience for you.
Plus, it'll mm-hmm. make you smarter and more empathetic, mm-hmm. and it'll improve your critical thinking. And it's just a win-win-win.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was going to say hotter. I mean, there's all these celebrities carrying around their books now. It's the latest trend.
Sure,
so, I mean, it will make you hotter for sure. So, yeah.
Yes.
And I mean, this is on my mind because Dua Lipa just got married and she met her boyfriend, now husband, because they were reading the same book. So hot people do come together over books.
On the same page,
Buy books. Buy books, get matched.
Read them in public.
This should just be a slogan. Buy books, get matched. Yes. Okay.
Five books, you're hot. Okay, we can't end on a better note than that. So thank you so much for hanging out with us as our inaugural guest. We're just so thrilled you could be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm honored to be the trailblazer here.
Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "my story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right, How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.